Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
I'm Colin Patterson with you every week this summer. Welcome to the Friday Film Review. It's Boyd and Floyd Part 4. That's our reviewers Boyd Hilton and Nigel Floyd in a Fright Fest special. Actually, if we're being true to the genre, I think by Part 4 of the series, you'd be replaced by cheaper alternatives now, wouldn't you be? It's Part 5, the final edition next week, before it's the return of Mark and Simon in September. Busy week in films. We've had Angelina Jolie and Drew Barrymore both in London for premieres, but it's great to have two genuine beauties here. Boyd and Floyd will be reviewing no less than 7 films this week, including The Human Centipede. We've had to call up editorial guidance to ask about taste and decency and what you can actually say while reviewing that film.
Yes, there are quite a few taste and decency issues this week in the films. There's also Piranha 3D, which has, I will reveal at this point, gratuitous nudity all the way through. So I don't know how we'll describe that either.
Yes, and Fright Fest has a number of titles which are likely to fall foul of the censors, I think, including a Serbian movie and the infamous remake of I Spit on Your Grave, which in America went back to the censors 7 times before they would allow it a rating.
We want your thoughts as well, please. If you've seen anything at the cinema over the last week, text us or email us, mail@bbc.co.uk, or text 85058. And all summer, when Boyd and Floyd have been here, we've been trying to get to know your film tastes so listeners can make their own decision as to whether they trust you or not. And this week, 2 questions for you, because it's this horror theme. What is the film that has scared you the most?
Well, when I was a young lad, my father took me to see the Brian De Palma film Dressed to Kill, which is obviously an outrageous thing to do for I think I was about 12. But I really wanted to see it because the posters looked very exciting. And I did like the idea of seeing really scary films, and it absolutely terrified me. It was one of the classic stalk and slash films of that era, I think 1982. And I then became a huge fan of Brian De Palma. I think he's an absolute genius, and I love his films.
Was that good parenting or bad parenting?
It was good parenting, because even though it was, some might see it as grotesquely irresponsible, it's like a 12-year-old to see that film, which has a lot of nudity and really, really horrible violence in it, towards women as well. I'm completely well adjusted anyway, and I'm a big fan of films. And that was one of the big films that turned me into a huge fan of movies, because it's so beautifully made, as well as being sick and twisted.
Nigel Floyd?
Yeah, sick and twisted is about where I come in, I think. A film I absolutely love is David Cronenberg's Shivers, because that was a film I saw at a very, very vulnerable age, and it had such an effect on me. I'd read a tiny little review at the end of a kind of newspaper column and saying, by the way, there's this young Canadian filmmaker, David Cronenberg, who's made this kind of strange little film about venereal slugs, and they get into this apartment and all hell lets loose. And I thought, that sounds like me. Went to see the movie, and it really was a kind of life-changing thing for me, because from that point on, I had always been interested in horror. I'd always read horror stories. I always watched the things on TV, the kind of the late night BBC series and stuff like that. But I really then was kind of completely sold on the whole horror thing, and I've continued ever since.
And very briefly, a film that should have scared you but didn't.
Well, I don't want to be predictable, but because there is the film called The Exorcist, which it does scare you, but its sequels, and particularly the second one, which is often mentioned by the guy who usually does this show, I can't remember what it's called, Exorcist 2, The Heretic, is one of the least scary, supposedly theoretical horror films of all time.
I'd agree. Actually, I have to go out on a limb here and say The Exorcist doesn't scare me for one reason, which is very simple, which is it assumes when you go into the cinema that you believe in religion and you believe in God. In other words, it doesn't set up its own rules within the picture and then say to you, live within this world, and then we'll, you know, take you there and you'll have to believe everything that happens. It assumes that you're a Catholic, or, you know, that you're some kind of a believer, and then it follows on from there. So the first half of the movie, where they've got those terrible kind of arterial scans going on, I think that's really scary. When you get to the 12-year-old sort of strapped to a bed, I'm not quite so convinced.
Well, I've always been an atheist, but I was scared. scared. So, you know.
We've got a lot of text coming in this already. Garen High Wycombe says, scary horror movie, The Ring, not scary horror movie, wrong turn. Well, Red in Cherwell, what a great name, says, Event Horizon, perfect mix of psychological and physical horror. Well, Mike Garvey says, the Japanese film edition has a horrible scene where a woman is sat across a guy's chest, pushing needles into him, chanting, Kiri, 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 which he thinks is Japanese for deeper, deeper, deeper. The night I saw this, I went to sleep and had a nightmare. Weight in my chest, needles. Kiri, Kiri, Kiri. He woke up with a start. His cat was sat on him. I've had an email during the week. So I think it's an email of complaint. Anne from Warwick says, Dear Sly Boyd, Floyd Willis and Cole Rourke. Glad I got Rourke.
Yeah, Rourke's good.
I was, you know, interested listening to, you know, Statham's interview, you know, last week, you know, such a man of great, you know, oratory and, you know, eloquence. I will not, you know, be bothering with, you know, the Expendables. That's in relation to Jason Statham's appearance on this show last week.
Were you supposed to edit them out? Is that what we're supposed to do?
Well, sometimes you do.
Do you?
Sometimes you don't.
What if it's live? Then you can't edit it out.
Exactly,
you know. If he does that, then that's his fault, isn't it? It's not your fault, Colin.
You know, it's time to go into the top 10. Tinkerbell. And The Great Fairy Rescue has entered the UK box office at number 10.
At number 10. I mean, this is a film for very young children. Basically, it's about a girl who believes in fairies. She captures a fairy in a little house that she's built specifically to try to entrap them. Her father, however, is a sceptical scientist, and he's the kind of man who likes to pin butterflies to bits of cork. So there's a conflict there. A lot of the action's revolving around the fairies themselves. Quite nicely animated, but a bit innocuous.
And Michael Sheen not playing Tony Blair in Tinkerbell.
No, for once playing somebody who's not famous, just the sceptical scientist father.
At number 9, Cats and Dogs, The Revenge of Kitty Galore.
You love saying that title, don't you? Cats and Dogs, yeah, there are a lot of CGI animals in films around this week. Cats and Dogs, very, very average sequel to a pretty average original. The only good thing about it, as I say every week, is the title sequence, which is a Bond spoof.
At number 8, the A-Team have had an email from Tom in Gothenburg who says, I've been surprised at how sniffy all the reviews have been of the A-Team. I found it hugely entertaining and funny. No one has mentioned how good Charlton Copley, remember District 9, is as Murdoch. He nearly steals it, but they're all good turns. Smart script, great gags, no 3D action to pity, and it even takes time to comment on private security firms in Iraq and quote Gandhi.
Big claims there from Gothenburg. I went to a film festival once in Gothenburg. I have to say I had the nicest time, and they were the most hospitable people I think I've ever met.
And big fans of the A-Team.
That aside, the A-Team is not as described, it must be said. It's quite boring. I'm getting a bit fed up with this 70s, 80s nostalgia, I have to say, because very often the people who are making these films don't seem to understand the thing that appealed to people back then, and they seem to be making a completely different film and thinking that that would be enough to just carry you through.
Hey, speaking of 80s remakes, at number 7, it's The Karate Kid.
Yeah, Nigel's sick of 80s nostalgia, but The Karate Kid is the good version of 80s nostalgia. It's a very enjoyable, very well-made film, and it's deservedly doing better than the A-Team.
At 6, Step Up 3D.
Step Up 3D. We're not always fans of 3D, but it seems that dancing is perhaps its natural home. And although when we get to Piranha 3D, we'll see it also has other applications.
And number 5, straight in, perhaps lower than Disney would be hoping, The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, I have to say, I think this is officially a flop. It flopped pretty badly in the States. It hasn't done as well as the film that we're going to talk about in a minute that was the big rival for it, if you like, in the family movie stakes. I'm a bit surprised because this film is mildly entertaining, whereas the film we'll get to is this, number 3, isn't. So it's a big disappointment. And Jerry Bruckheimer produced this and Prince of Persia. Both haven't done particularly well at the box office, so he's going to have to do really well with Pirates 4.
At number 4, Night and Day. We still don't quite know why it's called that, but it's gone past the £5 million mark. It's been a big hit.
It's scary, isn't it? Cameron Diaz and Tom Cruise. Now, apparently, Tom Cruise decided to make Night and Day instead of making Salt. He was originally cast in the role that Angelina Jolie now plays in Salt. This was a mistake. He should have made Salt. It's a much better movie.
We'll be reviewing it after 3 o'clock. At number 3... The Last Airbender, and we've had an email on this. Dear Selleck, Gutenberg and Danson, long-time listener, first-time emailer, M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening was described as all right on last week's show when you were reviewing The Last Airbender.
Yeah.
Anything you'd like to say about that?
I was trying to be generous to poor M. Night Shyamalan, because he's having a hard time, let's face it.
Well, Jonathan Dye says... I don't think it's all right. I was on a date night at my local multiplex, thinking a scary film might be a comforting arm-over-the-shoulder experience. We've all been there with that one. What was inflicted upon me was the most awful film I've ever seen. In one scene, you could see the sound boom in the top of the screen. The acting was dreadful, and then it all turned out to be the trees. Come on, I defy anybody to like, / enjoy this film. The relationship went downhill after this film, and we broke up shortly after. I'm not sure if I can blame M. Night Shyamalan for that part, though.
It's not a good date movie, I would say that, but it isn't terrible. But that's my claim.
But The Last Airbender is at number three.
Which is terrible. At number three, I mean, you know, it's done better than Sorcerer's Apprentice, which surprises me. I guess there are fans of the original anime show who went to see it. That's my explanation as to why it hasn't done as disastrously as we might have expected, but I do think it's going to plummet down the chart next week. We'll see.
Bad word of mouth.
Terrible word of mouth. How boring, dull and tedious it is will soon be... Everyone will be talking about it as soon as they see it.
And at number two, it's climbing back up the charts for the second week in a row. It just will not go away. It's Inception.
Inception, what a terrific movie. And two things to say about Inception, I think. First thing, the word of mouth has been storming. People have loved it. They've told their friends about it. I'm still meeting people who are saying, I've got to go and see that film Inception. Is it really as good as everybody says? So there's still a kind of untapped market out there for this movie. And in addition to that, it's not a 3D movie, which means it doesn't suffer from the problem of getting bumped when the next 3D movie comes down the pike. A lot of these movies that are opening big, once something comes out a week or 2 weeks afterwards, they get bumped out of the big 3D screens. They're not taking the money. Inception is hanging in there and taking shedloads.
But Ed disagrees. He said he came back from Bolivia, where he'd been for a month, and went to see Inception. It was good, but not great. Filled with lots of nice little touches. The Ring. The storyline was interesting only due to its complexity. Ellen Page, far too young to play her role.
No. I've never heard anyone say nice little touches about Inception. It's such a huge, big, you know, monstrous film.
Yes.
That's a very interesting choice of words there.
And at number one, Toy Story 3.
Yeah, well, this is proving to be like a kind of very exciting story of our period doing this show, because every week it gets more and more successful, breaks new records.
It's become the Brian Adams Everything I Do off this
it really
film
has,
show run.
Yeah. I'm hoping by the time we finish our stint, it's going to be like kind of in the top three films of all time at the box office. It's number seven at the moment, and predictions by my colleague Charles Gunn, who knows about these things, are it'll be about number five on Monday when we have this weekend's tally. So it's got a couple of Lord of the Rings films to go through before it gets into the big top three. But it is a proper, genuine phenomenon. Everyone's seen it. People have seen it 2-3 times. And pretty much everyone likes it, apart from that bloke who wrote in a couple of weeks ago.
And thank you very much for all your text messages already on the films that are making you, or the films that really terrified you when you saw them. Gordon Stockport says, Texas Chainsaw Massacre scared me witless. Stephen Leeds says, the scariest film I've ever seen is Audition, which we were speaking about a minute ago. And Andy in Wiltshire says, scary films, I've never looked at clowns the same way after watching Stephen King's It. Thank you very much for all your text messages on the scariest films that you've ever seen. David in Cardos says, The Thing, Alien and the Blair Witch Project are the ones that really did it for him. John in Coatbridge, Scotland, not easily scared. Wolf Creek, very disturbing. Robin Cornwell says, scared out of his skin at 10 years of age, watching an American werewolf in London. And Matt in Cheshire says, he saw The Thing when he was 14. He watched it at his friend's house, just 400 yards from his own. It was the scariest one-minute walk home of his entire life. And also let us know the films that didn't scare you that were meant to. We'll read out as many of them as possible. But Alan Jones is here. He's a man who knows a lot about scary movies because he is the founder of Fright Fest, which is why we're dedicating the show to horror this week, because it starts for the 11th time on Thursday coming up. Let's get the question out of the way. We've been asking everyone today, the scariest movie you've ever seen.
I'm still going to say Psycho, because it really did sort of like hit the nerve when I was at the age that I didn't quite understand what horror was and what it could actually do. And when I went to see it in the cinema in the mid-60s in a reissue, I mean, I could see what everyone was talking about, you know, because it was one of those real famous ones. And of course, that's the one that actually set the seal on practically everything that's come down the pike since. So, you know, it's a good one to choose, I think, that one.
At the time it came out, was it called a horror film?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah, I mean, you know, you could tell. I mean, you know, the graphics on it, you know, I mean, what with Janet Leigh screaming, I mean, you know, in slashes, like Saul Bess's title slashes all the way down. Yeah, it was obviously that, pitched as that, sure. Hitchcock, you know. I mean, he hadn't done one really before, but, you know, this sort of, like, set the seal on his reputation too, even though he's only done two horror films, really.
You sometimes hear Rebecca
getting top.
Yes. A bit too demure for me, that one, I think.
Good word.
Now, for people who don't know about Fright Fest, explain the concept.
Fright Fest began like 11 years ago, and it was just like a, you know, something we thought we'd do at a weekend for other like-minded fans. So we set on, you know, thought Prince Charles Cinema, 2 days, let's put on a few movies we thought other people might want to see. And it's just built to this. I mean, you know, from like the first 200 people we had back then, we had literally, I think, over 30,000 through the doors last year, and even more this year, this as it looks like. Unbelievable to me. So we obviously got something right. I mean, also, London, Britain, was crying out for this sort of film festival anyway. Nigel and I go to a lot of them around the world anyway, and we've never understood why there's been nothing here of a similar ilk, like the one in Sitges, for example, or Brussels. And I think we've actually got it right. We seem to have, like, you know, hit the right time for it all to sort of snowball as well. I mean, the genre has become much more popular in the last 15 years, so with both sexes, so we've hit that too.
See, are horror fans different to fans of other genres?
They're more dedicated, they're more friendly, they're far nicer. Do you know something? If I had the choice between being in a lift that was crashing to the floor with my family or some horror fans, I'd choose the horror fans any time.
Or fans of romantic comedies. Yeah.
So talk us through some of the big films that are showing at Fright Fest.
I mean, there's quite a lot of this. I mean, you know, one of the best things about Fright Fest for me is the fact the distributors really get what we are doing. And so they actually allow us to sort of show some really sort of like good stuff. And for me, Monsters is one of the best films, not just of this year, but for a long time, a British movie by Gareth Edwards. I love it so much. I don't want to talk about it too much, because I think if you build up too much expectation in that movie, it's sort of like people come out and go, wasn't as good as you said it was. So I'm trying not to get too excited. I've seen it 3 times. I've cried every single time. So that should give you an inkling of where I'm at.
How common are tears at a horror film?
Well, rare, aren't they? But in this one, it's more a romance than it is a monster movie, which is one of the things that's difficult to cope with. But you'll see what I mean when you've seen it.
So we've got Monsters.
Yes, Monsters. Well, F. Of course, I'm stylishly wearing the crew T-shirt here for people who can't see. But no, Johannes Roberts, I mean, it's one of the best British movies I've seen. We got that completely submitted through the post. It literally just turned up. Would you show this? With no idea what it was. Saw it, loved it. We thought, it's in like a flash. And the same reason was for The Dead, too. I mean, you know, which was just a brilliant zombie movie. I mean, I'm sick of zombie movies, frankly. This is the only one we've got on. But it's something really special because it just looks so great. And it was shot in West Africa, and it really gives it a sort of a Richard Stanley flavour in a way. It's quite extraordinary.
And the director, Howard J. Ford, will be joining us in about 20 minutes' time. Now, you say you're fed up of zombie films. Why?
I think I've seen it all now. I mean, you know, George Romero does them, you know, once every 2 years, you know, fair enough. But, you know, it's the genre that I'm least interested in at the moment. I just want to see something else. But it's a staple now. It's become one of the ones that people think, I know how to do that. I'll get a bunch of my friends together. We'll just throw a bit of ketchup over us and sort of like amble slowly towards the camera and we can make a zombie movie. If only it were that simple.
So you get sent movies just on spec.
Oh, yeah. There
must be some appalling stuff.
You have no idea what we have to sit through. 99% of them are rubbish, but that 1%, I mean, this year we got F, we got The Dead. What can you say? That's a good year.
And you were saying that the zombie subgenre is one you're bored of. What are the interesting aspects of the horror genre at the moment? Where is it heading?
Ooh, it's so diverse, I think. That's the most interesting thing about it. I think, you know, you can look around and you can see so many different threads going everywhere, from supernatural. I mean, just, there's so much different stuff. You know, we're back to the exorcism stuff with, you know, Eli Roth's production of Daniel Stamm's The Last Exorcism. We loved it so much we decided to close with that because it just really, really works. So you've got that. I mean, there's anything goes in horror at the moment. I don't think there's any particular thread you can sort of launch on, really, is there?
I mean, no, there's not. It's odd. It's become, I mean, horror's always been very Catholic, but obviously the mainstream studios try to funnel it into whatever was the last thing. So if you make Nightmare on Elm Street, then there'll be 10 or 12 movies that are just like Nightmare on Elm Street, or at least think they are. What's interesting now is that with all these remakes of the old 70s slasher movies, you've got that running in parallel with people coming up with completely original stuff like The Dead. I mean, yes, it's another zombie movie, but because of the setting and because of the way that it's shot, it feels fresh, it feels new.
Mm. How excited were you to have British horror films?
I see it as our mandate to do. I mean, you know, we are a British festival, and of course we've got to accent, you know, British talent and give them a profile that perhaps they wouldn't get normally. I mean, you know, we've got other films on like Dead Cert, Isle of Dogs. These are two other British movies. So, you know, it's good for them all to come together, and like we can showcase them and say it's good. Also, they're usually local, and they can travel in and support the films as well. So that's quite useful.
Yeah, that's a big thing about a festival, I think, because if you just put on a series of films, it's not a festival. A load of films just strung end to end is not a festival. If you've got the filmmakers there, if they're hanging around with the fans, because basically they are fans themselves. That's how they got into the business in the first place. They're hanging around, talking to people, doing Q&As after the movies. They mix with everyone. All the fans mix with each other. As Alan says, it's one of the friendliest places you could go because the whole horror community is completely international. You can go anywhere in the world, as we have. We've been to Milan, we've been to Sitges in Spain, we've been to Oporto in Portugal, we've been here and there.
Go to nice sunny places.
Well, yeah, of course.
Yeah, don't go to the cold ones. No. Sundance, forget.
Yeah, exactly.
And then sit in the dark.
Yeah, sit in the dark and watch people being bludgeoned to death.
How well do British horror films travel abroad? Because when thinking of the state, you know, Shaun of the Dead did make the top 10 over there. Apart from that, I remember things like The Wicker Man famously flopped over there, although it didn't do that well here either. But what have been the big British films that have travelled abroad, or does it just not happen?
I think the very fact that of their Britishness, I think the more localised they are, it works with any genre, I think it sells it abroad. I mean, I think F's going to do very well internationally, just I think from a remake point of view, from the American side of things as well. I know that's been one of the things they wanted to do with that, because it's not just that when people buy the distribution rights now in other territories, it's not just to release the films in that country, it's actually because they're thinking, ooh, this will make a good local remake. So America have done that a lot. So yeah,
so people are making the films in Britain, they'll buy the films, take them to the States, and then stick Brad Pitt in them.
Yeah, well, absolutely, yes.
There do seem to be more and more young, new British filmmakers whose first thing they decide to do is make a horror film. And I wonder whether there's something about the genre that kind of gets them, they can kind of show off almost, can't they, their skills as a director, and even the actors can show off more in a horror film than they can
I've always said it's the cheapest way into the industry because, you know, horror film fans will go and see anything, no matter how bad it is, just to check it off a list. And if you are in any way good, you'll be mentioned. Especially now, in the sort of like the internet age, you'll be blogged about all over the place before you even know it. And there'll be this want to see factor that didn't exist up until 20 years ago, I don't think.
Your texts are absolutely flooding in. Dear Stallone, Statham, and Willis, this Expendable Things is getting out of hand now. The scariest film I've ever seen, Event Horizon, still a shocker today, even with the now dated visuals. The unscariest, Paranormal Activity. What was that all about? A camera in my room all night with my terrier falling off my bed at 5 a.m. would be more entertaining and probably scarier. When Gary the Trucker says, The Exorcist scared me to death when I watched it on video when I was 18. I'm now 48 and I've never, ever watched it again. While Peyton Harrogate says, while watching Carrie in the late 70s as a young lad, I jumped out of my seat with the rest of the cinema when the hand came out of the ground. It felt like there'd been an earthquake. I think a lot of you will be able to identify with that. We're talking horror. We've got Alan Jones, the founder of Fright Fest, in the studio, and we've been asking you for your scariest movie of all time. Mark in Norfolk says, last Saturday we had a scary movie and beer night for my stag night. American Werewolf in London, The Exorcist and The Sixth Sense, plus loads of ale. None of us have recovered yet. The wedding is tomorrow, so congratulations, Mark. Well, a different Mark in Colchester says, scary movies, The Descent brought on my claustrophobia and made me start smoking again after having given up for 3 years. I've given up again since, but won't watch the sequel. Well, Brian in Hitchin says, watched A Nightmare on Elm Street when I was 12 years old at a friend's house. The walk home was a surreal experience, living in complete fear, walking in the dark, and that night I was delirious with twisted memories of that walk home spliced with Freddy Krueger behind every bush and round every corner. Makes me feel 12 again, just relaying it. And someone disagreeing with Alan, Mike and crew, dear Shenzai, Banzai and Ed, a film that I was told was going to make me have sleepless nights for weeks was Psycho. I watched it, didn't flinch at all. It could possibly be because my generation can't appreciate Hitchcock's way of direction, having been grown up during the blood and guts Sam Raimi era. I have, however, watched Rear Window and Vertigo and found them very enjoyable, which shows I do enjoy Hitchcock's movies. So maybe I just don't think Psycho's very good. Alan, for people who have grown up and grown up in the 80s and the 90s watching the horror films, does that affect it when they go back and watch 70s films?
Oh, I'm sure it does. I'm still surprised that Carrie features so heavily for people, because that does show its age remarkably now. I mean, I love the film, but boy, does it look 70s. Whatever film frightens you at that time is what you sort of always set the bar by, I think. When people tell me, oh, Zombie Flesh Eaters is the one that scared me, I'm just shocked because it's such a terrible film. Yet, people really were affected by it. So, yeah, sure. You know, I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah, Jules and Rossendale says Carrie. That's her one. Also Salem's Lot and The Thing she's gone for. And you are showing a real classic at Fright Fest.
Which one?
The Texas Chainsaw.
Oh, sorry, that. Yes. Sorry, yes. Toby Hooper. Yeah, we asked him to come over in conjunction with Total Film Magazine, which is why we're calling the whole section Total Icon. Seems to work quite well. 18 years since he's been here. So, yeah, I mean, it's really exciting for us. I mean, last year our icon was sort of John Landis, who I think will be around again, you know, lurking, because him and Toby are quite good friends. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's good to see. And we're showing Eggshells, one of the rarest films ever to see in Toby's sort of career, literally the very first one. And if you see it, you can actually see all the pointers to Texas. It's quite extraordinary how, you know, one's a sort of like a hippie, dippy fantasy, and the other one is like a real all-out-there horror movie. But you can see the stylistic, you know, similarities. It's quite interesting.
And the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, explained some of the problems it had with censors when it first came out.
Oh, dear. I mean, you know, it's interesting to me because you don't actually see any blood. That's the thing that everyone forgets about it. It's all about the impact of what you think you see. It's such a clever film visually, because you really are scared of being scared, I think, is the thing there with that film. A very hard thing to achieve for a lot of people. I think, in fact, The Exorcist is another one, I think, that does manage to do that. But no, so, yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I decided to do this whole Video Nasties debate that we're having, because we are showing the remake of I Spit on Your Grave as well, because, you know, it all seemed to key in, and Toby's actually going to be on our Video Nasties panel, because, of course, his film was actually one of the titles, and it was also was The Funhouse, or Eaten Alive was the other one, I think, that got put on that list, that very famous list, the shopping list that we all thought, oh, let's see this quickly and tick it off.
So these were the movies that were banned.
Yes, these people don't realise the moment you ban anything, people want to see it, don't they? So, you know, I wish they'd sort of get that into their little, you know, minds. But anyway, no, we're delighted to welcome, you know, Toby over. And, you know, thanks to Total Film for helping us with that.
Yeah, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre does still stand up. I mean, bizarrely, there is that sense of anticipation about that movie, because it was banned over here, the circumstances under which I saw it were quite odd, because I was living in Brighton then, and I went to the Brighton Film Theatre, and the only condition under which it could be shown as a one-off screening was that the esteemed film critic Alexander Walker, an extremely erudite and extremely smart man, came and defended this hideous Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie, which, as Alan said, doesn't have any blood in it, but it has a way of getting you to a point where you are so on edge, and then something very quick and often not particularly nasty happens. For instance, the scene where Leatherface first appears, grabs the girl, pulls her back, and then slams the metal door shut. The moment that kind of happens in the film, everyone in the whole cinema is then on edge. It's like all the safety rails have been removed, and from then on, the whole film's completely relentless, and the screaming just goes on.
A lot of those films, the incredible thing about, I'm so glad you're having the debate about the Video Nasties, and there's a documentary, isn't there?
Yeah, we're going to show that, yes.
Yeah. It's that so many of those films, it's the idea of them, isn't it, that was completely out. People couldn't take the idea of a film called Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's got chainsaws in it, and there's a massacre, and we think it's going to be so horrible we can't deal with it, and we're going to ban it, even though there's absolutely no blood. It was astonishing to think, in this country, in this democracy, they were banning films because of the idea of them, really.
Yeah, I Spit on Your Grave is a classic example. example. I mean, the guy who made the original, Mayer's Archie, he wanted to call it Day of the Woman, but of course that didn't have an exploitative title, so someone came up with I Spit on Your Grave. That then became one of the infamous video nasties. And in a way, if it's going to experience any problems, Alan says it's been cleared now for showing at the Fest, but if it were ever going to have problems, as it did in America, where it went back to the censors 7 times, it was just because it's called I Spit on Your Grave.
How big an impact is 3D having on horror?
It's one of the few. You mentioned dance movies. I mean, I do agree with you. I think it's great. I mean, I love Street Dance. I love Step Up 3D, I have to tell you. But with horror, it really works as well, doesn't it? I mean, you know, I thought My Bloody Valentine was absolutely spectacularly good. I mean, Piranha 3D... Oh, you're going to talk about that later. I shouldn't talk about that. But even Piranha 3D does it, doesn't it, in that sort of good gross-out sort of...
Yeah, I think our feeling is that's the natural home of 3D. Dance movies on the one hand and horror on the other. Let's go back to the gimmicky 3D. Let's not... have this arty
because they're cheesy B movies, really, yes, aren't yeah, they? But yes. Albeit with a bigger budget, yes, and kind of slickly made. But yeah, that's what they are. I mean, both of those.
Well, surely someone should combine them and make a horror dance movie.
It will happen.
Oh, God, what a fantastic idea! Quick,
can we sell that to America?
Street Dance, Street Dance Massacre. It's going to happen. Step Up to Your Grave.
I am so there for that.
I should mention as well, actually, that one of the regular TV reviewers on Richard Bacon's show, Tess Morris, has got a short film that's showing as well, which she produced, I think, The Rise of the Appliances.
Oh, that's fantastic. The short films are great, actually. And really, this year, sometimes they don't work out. Last year, we had to stop it because there weren't really that any good quality ones. But this year, we've actually come through with some really good stuff. That short film showcase is actually going to be a major one.
When's it on?
That is going to be on the Sunday morning. That's combined with Andy Nyman's Quiz from Hell, Andy Nyman being the star of Ghost Stories.
And one of the highlights of this year's Fright Fest is going to be The Dead. It screens on Monday the 30th. This is the trailer.
I'm stranded in hostile territory, under constant attack, without food or water. I need help.
My God, you're still alive.
You're American.
It's a long journey for me alone. Maybe it's not possible. I will come help. Maybe.
And we've already had an email in about it. Ram says, The Dead is the best zombie film I've seen by far. Howard Ford has done an incredible job. Great effort by the Ford brothers. Can't wait till I see it again at Fright Fest. Big studios better make a movie and get this talented director signed for future projects. Is this a friend of yours?
Yeah, well, actually, someone I think came to the... we had a preview in Cannes. This is a non-public screening, so it's not counted as a premiere. So we had some great responses to that, so thank you very much.
This is Howard J. Ford speaking. He has made a movie about zombies in Africa, nothing to do with England's World Cup performance, but tell us about the film.
Well, The Dead, it's basically my brother John and I, we're sort of the Ford brothers. We started making films 13 and 15 year olds as teenagers on Super 8. We always wanted to make a zombie movie, never got around to it. So 20 years later, this is the movie, and it's set in Africa. It's essentially a journey movie, actually a spiritual journey movie, believe it or not, set in the backdrop of zombies in Africa.
Do you set up any rules, as Nigel always asks?
There are certainly rules in terms of slow-moving zombies, because we think death is a disadvantage, so they can't run around like Olympic sprinters. And also, we actually wanted to ground the film in reality. Once you get, you know, John and I always said from the beginning, once you get past the fact that the dead are returning to life and attacking the living, once you can accept that, we really wanted to base the film in reality as much as possible. So, you know, with the imagery and using real locations, you know, this is not one of these movies that has a lot of CGI. It's not green screen, fake backdrops, which is being used. You know, we went right into the middle of locations that have quite literally never been seen before by the Western world, let alone photographed, and we take our audience on a journey across Africa with the living dead.
It's the Friday Film Review with Boyd and Floyd. Alan Jones is here, the founder of Fright Fest, which takes place over the bank holiday weekend, and one of the films that we'll be showing there on the Monday is The Dead, and the director Howard J. Ford is in the studio. And this film had some of the worst problems people have had while making a film. Try and explain some of the situations you ended up in.
All right, well, you'd really have to be there, but thankfully you weren't. But, well, for a start, in order to try and, you know, get these never-seen-before locations on screen, we were encountered gunpoint. Police stopped us at gunpoint. I was mugged at knife point. Had all my cards, cash, driving license taken in.
Which country was
this? This was in Burkina Faso, in the city of Ouagadougou. Even when my driving license was taken, I was then stopped by police for driving without the license that was taken. They tried to put me in jail. So it was all a case of, you know, buying our way out. And the lead actor, Rob Freeman, a fantastic actor from Canada, he contracted malaria and he collapsed, started convulsing on set, and was within 3 days of dying. The doctors, when we eventually got into hospital, said that if he hadn't been treated, he actually would have been dead within 3 days for certain.
There's a reason people don't make films in Burkina Faso, by the way.
Well, there probably is, but I suppose, you know, we wanted... John and I wanted to do was something that had never been done before. We didn't want to take the safe route and, you know, a relatively safe route and go to South Africa, stay in a nice hotel and then pop our little way into Africa. We wanted to take people to locations that had never, ever been seen before. So often the villages you see... in this journey through the film, you're taken to places that you would never ever get to see in any other movie.
Nigel, you've seen it. How different a horror film is this?
Very different, I think, and I love the way it looked. I mean, the boys have done a fantastic job, I think, because this is, as Alan was saying earlier, a kind of genre that's kind of been played out quite a lot recently. There'd been a lot of sort of George Romero rip-offs that haven't really, you know, worked. There have been some remakes that haven't really worked, and what Howard and John have managed to do is to breathe some new life into the zombie thing. And I think the fact that you were there, it's the spirit of its making as much as anything that I admire. The fact that the two of them just went out there and said, we're going to make this movie, we'll encounter problems they can have had no idea of the scale of them. Of course, you were there for 5 weeks, I think, without any equipment.
Absolutely. It took us over 5 weeks to get with, you know, cast and crew, you know, staying there, eating, you know, staying in places, you know, drumming up expenses. Couldn't get our stuff out of the port. We'd go there every day, be like, oh, come tomorrow, just another $1,000 for the gate fee, then the release fee, and, you know, this, that, and the other. And we were kind of like walking money, I think.
Yeah. And you actually managed to meet real cannibals.
We did. This is a really quite bizarre. At first, a cannibal actually rode by on a bicycle, and he seemed like a lovely guy. He was actually one of the nicest guys I think we met while we were there. And
How did you know he was a cannibal?
No,
he was wearing a t-shirt,
yeah,
a head in his basket.
No, unfortunately not. Because we had translators there, and he stopped by and he saw our sort of, you know, flesh-eating, you know, white-eyed zombies.
Well, that's what I want. I want some of that action.
Exactly. Yeah. And he asked what we were up to, and then the translator said to me, come. This guy is a real cannibal, and he eats when people die in his village. As long as they're not too decomposed, he will eat the bodies. Yeah. And then at some point, it was getting dark at this point, and I remember that someone made a joke about, you know, had he tried any white meat, and looked at my thigh, and there was a little laugh, and I thought, hang on.
You tended to make a film of the making of the film, which could have been as horrific, if not more horrific, than the film.
Well, absolutely. In fact, there are several episodes going out online, you know, the making of the dead. You can find it by searching, and we're up to episode 2. There's episode 3 coming out soon. So you can see, actually, online footage of the shoot and us trying to get John and I trying to battle our way through this thing, and perhaps more horror than the film itself.
I agree with Nigel. It looks incredible. So what kind of I don't ask you to reveal the actual budget, but how did you get the money together? It looks absolutely fantastic for a film made in such circumstances.
Yeah, thank you. It was all private money. I mean, but you know, and I will reveal the budget in a year or so,
but not right now
when you invite me back on when we've sold it all around the world. But the fact is that, you know, John and I had shot over 100 TV commercials together, right. So we had a professional background that way, and we shot the film on 35mm film, rather than digital. So we wanted to give the film,
which makes such a difference, I think.
A huge difference. Yeah. It doesn't matter what anyone tells you about digital.
Absolutely.
You know, if you're trying to evoke a time and a place, and, you know, capture a journey, as we were, then shooting on film is really the only way. And to go to all these locations and nearly kill ourselves, you know, we wanted to capture it on the best format. So, you know, we strived hard to make it a beautiful film, as much as anything else. That was really important to
us. The importance to a film like this of Fright Fest?
Incredible. And the Fright Fest guys have really, really been fantastic, and we're so thrilled to be a part of it. And for us, it's great promotion. It's great for us to see the film with an audience who, you know, want to go and see such films. And as Alan was saying earlier, they're really great people and great to be around. So it's just a fantastic experience for us.
And what are the goals for a film like this?
Well, get out of there alive was our initial goal. And once that's been done, now we really do want the film to, you know, go on the cinemas all around the world. And we've gone to all of the effort to shoot stunning vistas. You know, we went out into the Sahara Desert and all of these things. So we really feel that this film should be shown on the big screen, and rather than, so you can appreciate, you know, this journey. And that's our hope, is a worldwide theatrical release.
Are you big horror fans, or because this film for me does something what I was trying to say before, that it's such a showcase for your talents, because it looks so good and technically it's so amazing that it almost feels like, oh, let's do this thing because we can really show off what we can do.
Thanks. Yeah, well, actually John and I have been horror fans as, you know, since we watched I was 12 and John was 14, and we watched Sam Raimi's The Evil Dead and George Romero's Dawn of the Dead, you know, and they utterly terrified us. And we had this ambition to make a horror movie, then a zombie movie, and we just didn't get around to it. And actually, John, over the years, you know, we had a really, really good career in commercials, honing our skills, you know, trying to get our filmmaking up to the standard when we could make this film. And John, every 6 months, would, you know, say, what about this zombie movie we never made? And he'd be chipping away with notes on it. And we'd be sitting there doing a soap commercial or a nappies commercial, as it turned out. And then he mentioned it one more time. And in a moment of weakness, I said, you know what? Let's do this. And if we do it in Africa, we've got something that no one else has ever done.
And you had experience of filming in Africa because you just worked with Michael Essien, I believe.
We did. Obscure connection. But we shot commercials in Ghana and Nigeria and places like that. So we had been to Africa. And one of them, one of the commercials starred Michael Essien, which was, you know, shot in the a stadium in Accra. And it was portraying Ghana winning the World Cup. You know, it was a really positive, and actually they did quite well against the Americans, I understand.
You should have gone to do a cameo.
It would have been great. You know, I think we had like he popped in for like 20 minutes or something. We had to do all his shots there and off he went. Didn't get time to ask him.
Thank you all again for all your text messages on the scariest films you've ever seen. Kieran in Brighton says, Children of the Corn, I was 7 years old. My older cousins should have known better. This is a very common thread. There's always someone older that's showing the films. Nick in Glasgow, Friday the 13th, first slasher film I'd seen. That film, particularly the ending, stayed in my mind for a long time. What's your choice?
For me, well, I'd say the most scared I ever was at Sam Raimi's The Evil Dead. I mean, I remember coming home from watching that. I'm just so utterly terrified. Same as Dawn of the Dead. But I still think, you know, I'm with Gary the Trucker who texted in earlier, you know, The Exorcist. You know, I believe there is no scarier film. That taps into something.
So The Dead's on Monday. Where can people get tickets for Fright Fest, Alan?
Just the Empire Cinema, but go to www.frightfest.co.uk.
What was that thing anyway? What was it?
Look, we're going to stay here and wait for help.
Stoner's dead, man!
I can't see him letting me in, Johnny.
Me and Stephen have decided to go for the gun.
Hello? Hello?
Oh, my God!
It's okay. Shh.
It's in the room. It's in the room.
That's a clip from 13 Hours, which had its world premiere, or has its world premiere, at Fright Fest next weekend. Gemma Atkinson and Isabella Calthorpe are two of the stars. They join us now. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Were you getting memories flashing
yeah,
back
I was
of filming?
Listening back, yes.
Of course, a lot of people know you, Gemma, originally from playing Lisa in Hollyoaks. And Isabella, you were recently in ITV2's Trinity. And I saw you on your first night of doing Dirty Dancing, which was a massive West End
hit. Which was really fun. I think they're just about to finish their final year now, but they've done about 5 years it's lasted.
Is that how long it's been on there?
Yeah.
It's a lot of watermelons.
Yeah.
Yes. So what can you tell us about 13 Hours? Because obviously you can't, with all horror films, there's only a certain amount you can say or you give away too much.
Exactly. I've always already noticed one of your questions here, actually.
Who's printed out my questions? Nigel?
You left questions in front of the guests.
Say, Colleen, you might embarrass the guests in front of me.
It's basically a werewolf horror. There's six friends trapped in a house, and all kinds of things start to unfold as a storm. You know, the typical horror movie. But yeah, it's fun. We had a great fun filming it. It was so long ago now, wasn't it? About a year ago. Mm. But it was a great cast. 3 week shoot in this old, like, creepy house. But yeah, it was good.
How scary does it get then?
I think it gets pretty scary.
Yeah.
We got quite hyped up and scared filming it, didn't we,
Jen? Yeah, it was like a lot of shoots from 4 in the afternoon till 4 in the morning, so it was like throughout the night. So you'd be like having your tea break in the woods, kind of like looking around, glancing. But no, yeah, I think people will be surprised, really.
And it does have a lot of horror conventions that it plays along to, the people trapped in the house on the dark night.
Yes. Yeah, and even actually, there's one element of the creature that they're being hunted by, but also there's, as a group of friends being trapped in a house, they all start turning against each other and become a bit of a danger to each other as well as what they're being hunted by, which adds another kind of nice,
interesting level to it. Yeah, I think that's important, because a lot of horror films have that now. I mean, The Descent, for example, is a terrific example of that. All the girls go down into the cave, but as well as the monsters that are attacking from without, there's a lot of tension within the group, and people are starting to turn on each other. They want to be a part of a group and sort of fight the monster together, but there's a certain amount of background which we can't reveal. You're, for example, going out with... Gemma's going out with Isabella's ex-boyfriend, so there's a certain amount of tension there built in right from the outset.
Yeah, there's sort of, it becomes two camps, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah, it does, and under the circumstance. Everyone's kind of stressed and all different ideas of what they can do to survive, and obviously the ideas clash and the characters clash. So, it's interesting.
And there's been quite a lot of fanboy interest in this for the last year because Tom Felton... Draco Malfoy from Harry Potter is in it, and it's a filthier Tom Felton than we've seen before.
It is, yeah, he's not so nice in this one. Yeah, he was great to work with, though. It was fun, so hopefully we'll get a lot of Harry Potter fans tuning in for that reason.
I think they get a bit of a shock if they're off a certain age, though.
Yes, they will do.
But I did like the fact that his character and the kind of banter between the young people in it is quite realistic. It's quite well done. That it's kind of, there's a feeling that you're all talking in the way that real young people do talk. And I thought that, and the script is actually pretty good for this kind of, I mean, you know, I don't want to say this kind of film, put it down, because they say how good horror films are, but they can be quite cheesy, can't they? And when you read the script, did you think, actually, this is a pretty decent thing, this could be a proper kind of quite good piece of work?
Yeah, I think because it is quite character driven, there's a lot of stuff that's going on between all the characters. And also I think because we filmed it in such a short space of time, we all got to know each other very well, and we were literally trapped in a house for a month till 11:30 every night. So it became quite almost improvised.
So you're genuinely in distress throughout the filming,
and a lot of laughing as well.
Okay. Nigel, how important are budgets to horror films? They're saying it's low budget.
Not at all, quite honestly, because if you think about something like the Blair Witch Project, which was shot for, you know, 2p, it works. If the idea is strong enough, then the film will work, and horror films are much more forgiving than any others. I do have to say at this point, though, for Gemma and for Isabella, you have no idea what it's going to be like when they screen this film at Frightfest. It's like the Christians and the Lions at Frightfest. I mean, they love the gore moments, but they get involved in the story as well.
Really?
And your personal appearances at the festival will be one of the highlights. It's going to be a good show, and it's a great place for it to be showcased, because these are the hardcore fans. These are the people who are going to support this film and push it into.
Are you saying they're going to be mobbed by?
I think there's a fair chance. I think there's a fair chance, but they're less maladjusted than you fear.
What advice would you give them?
It's good to know. I'm glad people are supporting.
No, embrace it. Yeah, enjoy it.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, we want to obviously please the horror fans. There's people out there who are, you know, like you say, they love the gore. So if they're going to come down and support it, then, you know, the more the merrier.
Do people dress up to go to Frightfest?
No, people generally wear, you know, what they think of as a classic T-shirt. So you'll see people there with a, you know, with a zombie flesh eaters T-shirt. You'll be see people there dressed in hideous kind of goth outfits. I've never got the goth thing. I don't get that doomy, gloomy thing. On the other hand, you'll see people incredibly sartorially elegant, like myself, wafting about, watching all these films, and having a right rip-roaring time.
Were either of you fans of the genre before?
Yeah, I've always been into horror films, really. Not in a kind of sick, gory way, just there's something about being scared that it's a good feeling when you're scared. When you, for some reason, if there's something that scares me on telly, I'll put my hands in my ears thinking that'll make it better for some reason. And it's that kind of feeling of, you know, the adrenaline of, that I kind of like being scared watching films.
We've been getting a lot of texts in today, the most scared people have ever been watching films. Fiona in Hexham says, "Don't Look Now scared me witless as a kid." Tim in Colne says, "The original Romero, Dawn of the Dead, still terrifies me." Martin Howell says, "If you can watch a Eraserhead without feeling like you're in a nauseating nightmare, you are stronger than most." What's the most scared you've ever been watching a film?
I think, for me, I think it's the first one you see, you know, when you're still quite young and you're still quite, you know, vulnerable, and you haven't really sort of got really used to watching loads. And I think maybe The Exorcist for me, because it was the first one I saw. But then I remember we experimented by turning down the volume, and suddenly it wasn't frightening at all.
Oh, clever.
But yeah, that, and there's another film, The Exorcist of Emily Rose, that I saw that.
Oh, that's awful, yeah.
Really,
oh, yeah,
that was a couple of years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, they've done a new one of that, I think.
Yeah, there's a I think it's showing at Fright Fest.
Well, Last Exorcism will be the closing film at Fright Fest. I would recommend you see it if
I'd
you
like
get the chance
to
see it. It's,
yeah.
It's quite good because, it's again, it's that kind of fake documentary thing. So the guy is a guy who used to be a preacher and did exorcisms, but he gets this film crew in and he says, "I don't believe any of this stuff anymore. I'm going to show you how it works. I'm going to show you how I fake it." And then, of course, they go there. And then the more time goes on, the more you begin to believe that perhaps actually the girl is possessed by something and he's been sort of caught up in it.
Wait, when you watched the film, your film, Back for the Sun, was it? Did you get that it was going to be scary? Did you feel, oh, yeah, this is definitely a scary film?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, really?
To be honest.
Okay. Oh,
Isabella's seen it, but I've not. I'm going to be, you know, a new experience for me as well with everyone
else. So you'll stay in the screening at Fright Fest?
I will, yes. Yeah. I want to see people's reactions.
It is very effective, I have to say, isn't it? It's a really effective. One of the clever things about it is they keep the beast, if you like, quite well hidden. It's got that Jaws type thing of let's not show much of it for a large part of it, and that works very well.
I always think that works the best.
Yeah, definitely.
The director has emailed in to say hello to both of you. Jonathan.
Oh, Jonathan. Yeah.
Hi.
Very
Jonathan.
Happy to hear Gemma and Isabella.
We should say he's done a very good job. We haven't mentioned that. He's done a really good job, I think. I think it's another thing where it showcases the atmosphere of the film, the kind of the way it works, and the parceling out of what you see of the werewolf is very, very clever, I think.
Yep.
He was really good on set as well, wasn't he?
Brilliant.
With the notes and things, and obviously putting up with us lot together, like Isabella said, we were like trapped. But no, he was really passionate about the script, which I think helps. You know, if the director wants it to be a certain way and they're passionate about it, that kind of, it's easier to do your job, if that makes sense.
Yeah, passion is the key word, I think. I mean, so much of what we see at Fright Fest is films by first and second time directors because they're trying to carve a niche for themselves, and their films have that passion. They're driven to make them. They're not making them because they're a nuts and bolts director and here's a project and it's just something that they can do until they get to make the film they wanted to make. This is it. They put every ounce of their being into this movie.
Is this his first film?
And when it works, it works.
The director's first film.
No, I think he's done quite a few.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Before we let you go, though, you've both been working on the stage as well. You've got one coming up, Gemma?
Yeah, I'm in rehearsal at the minute for a play by Neil Labute called This Is How It Goes. We open at the King's Head on the 7th of September, so I'm just rehearsing that at the minute.
Oh, he did the remake of The Wicker Man, didn't he, Nigel?
He did, and made a right hash of it, doesn't he?
Hopefully he won't do the same with your play.
No, hopefully not.
And Isabella, you've been doing a play that was a play that's an unusual version because it's the play off the movie.
Yeah, it was a play called Backbeat, which was the movie Backbeat on stage, directed by the guy that wrote and directed the film, Ian Softley. And I played Astrid, who was the muse of the Beatles when they were in Hamburg, and who was in love with the fifth Beatles, Stuart Sutcliffe, who died when he was 21, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've just finished that, and now we're hopefully waiting to see if it all transfer into the West End. So.
That was all in Glasgow, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Citizens.
Yeah.
How did they treat you?
Well, they loved it. I think you're either a Stones fan or a Beatles fan, so we had a bit of a mix of both. But the biggest compliment, we had Stones fans in who were like, "We're a Stones fan and we love it." So, you know,
were people turning up in the T-shirts then? Like Nigel was saying, for Fright Fest, people turn up for Backbeat in Beatles T-shirts.
Yeah, we did have a bit of that kind of thing. They're such a well-loved band, and, you know, we had a lot of fans there, but it was really fun, really fun.
And 13 hours shows at Fright Fest on the Saturday, 3:15 in the afternoon, so at least if you're terrified, you're going to be leaving in the daylight.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining
you.
Us in
Thank
the studio. Well, it's time to crash on, because we've got 7 movies to get through in the next 45
minutes. And you promised we'd do all 7.
We're going to do all seven. And we've had an email about the first one, Salt. I think Tom Cruise probably turned down Salt because he's starred in so many films with the same plot line. An agent is wrongly accused of a crime he didn't commit and must prove his innocence. He's done this already in the first Mission Impossible, Minority Report as well. In fact, the basic plotline of Night and Day is similar to Salt. Maybe he just fancied having a laugh. That's from Lucia in Chorley. Boyd.
Yes, that's a good point. So Salt, as we've established, it was aimed at Tom Cruise, and when Tom Cruise decided to do Night and Day instead, which came out a few weeks ago, they had to rewrite the script and turn it into a film about a female agent played by Angelina Jolie. And the great concept, the big kind of initial setup scene of this film, is where she goes back to the CIA. She's been rescued, got into a hideous situation. She's been rescued. She's got married. She's got her chum Liev Schreiber, who works for the agency as well, and her boss Chiwetel Ejiofor, and they're doing fine. They're back at the agency, everything's going well, and then this Russian defector arrives at the agency, walks in, demands to be interviewed by them, and he reveals that there is a double agent, there's a Russian double agent among them, and it is in fact Angelina Jolie's character Salt, and furthermore she is going to assassinate the president. And let's hear what happens at the fallout of this, when she decides they've got to do something about it, and she's got to get in touch with her husband, and we'll hear all of that in this clip.
Call protective services and make sure they find my husband.
Where are you going?
I need to get to the phone.
No. Not after the neural scan.
Because he didn't flutter? I can beat that thing 5 times out of 6.
I am trained to, and so is he. I need my phone. I need to call my husband.
Let me call my husband.
Let me see it.
There's a reason he mentioned my wedding ring to him. When they blow up a spy, they don't just blow up their cover, they blow up their whole cover life. You know that. Do you remember what happened to Henley's wife?
Yes, I do.
Honey, it's me. Please call me as soon as you get this. Okay, sweetheart? As soon as you get this.
Godspeed, Komarchenko.
Yeah, so that was Angelina worried that because she thinks she's being set up, basically. She thinks they're going to go for her husband. So there's peril. It turns out to be a very complex plot as to who's really a Russian spy, who isn't. And it's got one of those stories. I don't know if you've seen the film Eagle Eye, which came out a couple of years ago, where... It's so complicated, you can't quite work out what's going on. And by the end, you think, oh, OK, I've gone with it. And then if you think about it for a couple of minutes, it's incredibly implausible and none of it really makes any sense. But while you're watching it, it doesn't really matter. I did enjoy it. It's directed by Philip Noyce, the Australian director who made Dead Calm, which is a really good, that film with Nicole Kidman on a boat in peril. A really well-directed film set entirely on this boat in the middle of the water, and did a very good job. And he's since done kind of quite a few very good spy movies like The Quiet American, Clear and Present Danger. So he knows what he's doing. And what I liked about Salt was it's a proper film. I think unlike Night and Day, for example, and The A-Team, these kind of projects that we've seen in the summer that are aimed at being blockbusters and that are star vehicles, that feel like there are producers and studio people saying, let's throw this at it, let's throw that at it, let's have set piece scenes, let's film it in the style of the Bourne films and make it all shaky cam. This is directed in a very classic way to me, and that's what made it. Like, I really enjoyed the fact that it was in a way a Hitchcockian style spy thriller with interesting characters. She's great, she's a really good kind of action hero, convincing. There's a reason why they keep asking her to do these kinds of films, because she absolutely looks right in them.
And she's the only female action
star,
because basically.
She's so good at it, I think. You know, it's a shame they don't try other people in these kind of roles, but because she is so good at it, they keep coming back to her. For me, the one problem with it is, as I say, when you've finished and you kind of think about it for 1 minute, it just is so ridiculous that all of the... It's one of those things that people need to do things to guess what other people are going to do when they set up a situation. Everyone does exactly what they're supposed to do. How did you know that was all going to happen? That's the problem with it. But while you're watching it, it doesn't really matter. I think it's one of the better summer blockbuster, would-be blockbusters, and I hope it does better than Night and Day, particularly because it is much better than Night and Day.
And she does actually go and dragon it. There is a suggestion that might be her Tom Cruise tribute. Nigel, how different a film would it have been with
Tom
Cruise?
Well, I don't know. It makes you wonder whether we would have had a scene in which Tom Cruise dressed up as a woman. I'd pay money to see that. I think that basically it's exactly the same film, but tailored to her character. But she's done a lot of these movies. You know, she's done the Lara Croft movies. She's done Mr. and Mrs. Smith. She's done Taken. So she's got a pedigree as both a serious actress and as an action heroine. And she delivers. I mean, the stunts in this film Obviously, she didn't do them all herself. She's way too valuable to be risked on, you know, some of the stunts you see in this movie. But it's clear that she's involved in a lot of the running and the action and the fight scenes, and it's completely authentic. And it does feel a bit like a Bourne movie. It also feels a little bit like a slightly older movie, No Way Out, with Kevin Costner. Because, of course, all this Cold War stuff seemed like a lot of old tosh, didn't it? Until recently when, in a topical note, it was discovered that these Russian sleeper agents were actually in America preparing to go into deep cover and then reveal themselves later on and perhaps assassinate the president. Now, it is a bit preposterous, but as Boyd says, it moves so fast and it's so nicely put together. There's so much action going on all the time. You don't have time to think about the casting is the key to the movie here. Think about the parts that some of the people have played in previous movies. You'll work it out quite early on, as I did. On the other hand, it just rushes forward. And there's an English guy, actually, who edited this movie called Stuart Baird, who is one of the great unsung geniuses of Hollywood cinema. I interviewed him once when he made a film called Executive Action, I think it was called. And he is a genius. I mean, he just edits this film to within an inch of its life, and it never lets up.
But it is coherent, I think, for me. Unlike, you know, The A-Team, which to me was incoherent, you watch it, you know where everyone is, what's going on, it makes sense.
Yeah, we're not talking Quantum of Solace.
No.
I think you said Taken, by the way, when you meant Wanted.
Did I?
Didn't you? Yeah. Not trying to be pedantic.
I apologise.
Yeah, but Salt, they're obviously trying to line it up to become a franchise. Yeah. Does it have that power?
I'm not convinced. I mean, I don't know. It feels like a good one-off film to me. I mean, you know, I'm not sure how many more times we need to see Angelina Jolie doing this character. And I'm not sure if we need to see any spin-offs of it. I'm happy. Leave it at one for me.
I like your new nickname for her, Angeloni.
Angeloni. Oh, it's brilliant. Yeah. I can't say her name properly, so let's call her Angeloni.
It's time for the review of Piranha 3D.
Piranha 3D. I absolutely loved it. I think both Boyd and I are completely sold on this film. A lot of the remakes that we've seen recently have not understood the spirit of the films that they've actually been remakes of. This one does completely. And in fact, Alexandra Aya says that this was his attempt to recreate the guilty pleasure movies of his youth. And that's exactly what it is. It ain't subtle. It ain't politically correct. It has more gratuitous nudity and outrageous gore than you could shake a stick at.
Dave says, Piranha 3D sounds like what Snakes on a Plane should have been to me. Nigel, is he right?
That is exactly what it is. Back in 1978, of course, Joe Dante made the original, and it had a script by John Sayles that had a certain amount of sort of political undertow to it, because the piranha in that case had been created by the American military for use as weapons in Vietnam and had now escaped. There's none of that here. This is pure, straight down the line exploitation sleaze. So the story in brief is Lake Victoria is one of those places where when spring break comes in America, every bikini girl and every kind of pumped up guy arrives there, swells the population to about 50,000 overnight. They all go completely mental. Meanwhile, the piranha have escaped into the lake. The local sheriff is trying to keep the kids out of the lake. They're not taking a lot of notice of her, obviously. There's also a sort of sleazeball porn director who's got a couple of busty beauties out on the lake, together with a local boy who's rather shy and a little bit wet behind the ears, but he's kind of having quite a good time, along with a girl that he's got a bit of a crush on, who's also sort of the nice girl next door type, and the fish are in the water, and bad stuff happens. And it happens in 3D, and flayed bodies, and naked breasts, and vomit, and just about everything you can imagine gets flung out of the screen at the audience. I had a riotous time. It was a lot of fun.
And there's some famous names in this film. Yes. Oscar-nominated actress Elizabeth Shue, Ving Rhames, and the one of interest to Britain, Kelly Brook.
Kelly Brook, yes. Well, let's just say, Kelly Brook's first line in the film is, nice horn. I felt that the director, Alexandra Aya, was kind of using her in the most gratuitous way he could possibly find. He gets to spout ridiculous lines, and she's naked for pretty much the entire duration of her role in the film. There's some underwater nude swimming 3D action in this film that we can't fully describe at this family hour that is quite, that fans of Kelly Brook's work, shall we say, shall be rewatching on video on DVD repeatedly. Do you know what? She's not terrible in it, we have to say. So she has to actually speak these quite bad lines of dialogue, and she copes with it. There's the first scene, which I think sets the tone, is Richard Dreyfuss from Jaws in a boat singing the same song that he sang in that film, and then he gets killed by the piranha. It's exactly like what the film that Snakes on a Plane should have been. We've had lots of attempts to do knowing B-movies, I think, recently. For me, this is one of the best. It's absolutely ridiculous, riotous, brilliant fun, and the gratuitousness of it is so all-encompassing in every way. The deaths, some of the deaths are brilliantly creative, especially halfway through, I thought, actually, it's holding back a bit. You know, it's not quite as ridiculous and disgusting and gory as it could be. And then all hell breaks loose, and there's a death, for example, of Eli Roth is in it, playing the wet T-shirt host, and his death is tremendously creative. Again, we can't describe on a family show.
Yeah, I think Boyd's absolutely nailed it there. The thing about this is a remake of a film which was itself a rip-off of Jaws, made for no money.
Yes.
This is quite an expensive, laugh-out-loud remake of a film that was a cheesy exploitation picture in the first place, but it completely understands the mindset of the people who made the first film. And it's really, really got a big chance, I think, of being this kind of breakout horror hit.
I think it'll be a big hit. Yeah, you know, people want to see eyeballs coming at them in 3D. If you're going to have 3D, let them be eyeballs coming at you.
And better than Piranha 2, directed by James Cameron?
Most definitely. Do not see that film on pain of death.
Yeah, that was the flying piranha film. It didn't work.
Yeah.
It's time to move on to The Expendables. George in London says, Dear Lucy, Kit and Mimi, which I sadly know because they are the characters in Crossroads, the Britney Spears movie. I remember it to cover the premiere where she was booed. As two films have been released in the past weeks dealing with American attitudes to South America, it seems sensible to combine them into a double bill, an idea that, to my knowledge, has yet to be taken up by a cinema. So last night we went to see South of the Border, followed by The Expendables. It was entertaining to watch Oliver Stone's bumbling effort to humanise the Bolivarian leaders of South America, followed by a film centred around a South American leader who, resplendent in a standard-issue sinister goatee and military uniform, stands on balconies roaring, "We will kill this American disease."
And a bunch of left-wing quasi-Marxists followed by a bunch of right-wing Hollywood stars.
Yep, well, The Expendables. The thing to do if you want to get in the mood for this is to watch on the internet something called The Expendables, The Call to Arms trailer. Okay, now in this film, you see nice little clips from Twilight and Sex and the City and the Oprah Winfrey-approved Eat, Pray, Love with Julia Roberts. And the suggestion is that the cinemas have been colonised by all these kind of girly films. You know, we don't want any of that. What we want is Sly Stallone and Jet Li and Mickey Rourke and Jason Statham and Arnie whooping people
and Dolph Lundgren
in huge quantities and Dolph Lundgren, and that's what you get. I mean, basically it's a face off this summer between Eat, Pray, Love and The Expendables.
The Expendables won at the US box office,
and indeed it's sort of, well, we haven't yet seen Eat, Pray, Love, so we're going to reserve our judgment on that, but if you want a knucklehead action movie, this is the movie that you want. I mean, I personally enjoyed it in a kind of guilty pleasure kind of way. It's much better way made than the Rambo movie that Sly Stallone did before. He's taken a bit more trouble with the writing. The plot actually makes some kind of sense. It has Eric Roberts as a fantastic rogue CIA agent. Do the CIA have any agents who have not gone rogue?
No.
I asked myself at this point. But he's fantastic as the evil guy. Basically, the setup is it's like the Dirty Dozen or something like this. There's a bunch of guys. They used to be a team together. They're offered this job. It's clearly a suicide mission. They're offered it by Bruce Willis. Arnold Schwarzenegger turns it down. That was a clue, I think.
Yeah.
They go to this fictional South American island. There's a general there who's in league with Eric Roberts. He's a kind of corrupt right-wing dictator. Eric Roberts is just a sleaze bag who wants to grow lots of cocaine. They've got to rescue the daughter of the general, Sandra, who is beautiful, of course, and gets to do nothing. The women in this film are only there to be brutalized, tortured, used as hostages, and then saved by a good, strong man. This is not a film for feminists. It is, however, if you are an unreconstructed male or a reader of Nuts, this is your movie heaven.
I think you've chosen a bit of the film to enlighten us with.
Oh, yeah, we have a clip.
I'm sorry, I'd forgotten in all the excitement that we were going to listen to a clip.
Drop your guns!
I'll take the four on the left.
Why don't you take the two on the right and leave the rest alone?
You should take the two on the right. You're not that fast anymore.
The only thing faster is light.
We'll see.
Bullets go faster than blades.
Bring in money! Here! Now!
You want the money? Go get it.
What's that?
In a text.
Excuse me?
Get out!
call that a tie.
Come on, you dreaming.
I think that pretty much tells you all you need to know. Christian from Boston says, saw The Expendables on Wednesday. This film rocks. 10 out of 10. Do you agree, Boyd?
No, I wouldn't give it 10. Sorry to be a bit of a spoiler. But I mean, I did enjoy it. The screening I went to, a huge cinema in Leicester Square, people were applauding the opening credits. Every time one of these big star names came up, they got a big round of applause and cheering. And then people carried on cheering, like, you know, to the script editor came on, they were still cheering. There was kind of people love the idea of this film. It's a very great idea. You know, who doesn't want to see these kind of action heroes, people from B-movies as well, like the likes of Dolph Lundgren, all coming together with the modern action movie guy Jason Statham in a fun film? For me, the problem with it was that in the end, the actual film doesn't quite give them enough good stuff to do. There's all these guys together. You don't see them together that much until kind of right at the beginning. That scene you heard there is the opening setup, and right at the end. In the middle, there's a lot of just Statham and Stallone together. It's, you know, we'll go on for kind of 10-20 minutes with not that much happening. I was surprised by the fact that actually, in the cold light of day, they don't really, it's not quite as much fun as you think it's going to be, and perhaps as you think it is while you're watching it, if I can say that, because people are saying 10 out of 10. But I think really, it's not as much fun as Piranha 3D, in my opinion. I'm not saying it's not fun, it is entertaining, and it is great seeing all these doofuses together in one film, but I still don't think it's as entertaining as Piranha 3D.
Yeah, and it does have a big problem, which is that Sly Stallone is not known for his sense of irony. And quite honestly, if you're going to make a throwback 80s action man movie with all these muscled up guys and massive explosions and huge amounts of firepower, you do need to have some sense of irony about it. And poor old Sly doesn't. He plays it absolutely straight.
Yeah. And in fact, there's one scene in it where Mickey Rourke gets to do the "this is why we're all being meaningful and this is why we do this job" scene. That is excruciating, because they're trying to be sincere and, you know, make it like, let's all care about these people, let's be emotional from it. No, let's not. We just want to see people's limbs being hacked off, which you get to see as well.
Still to be reviewed, Mother, The Human Centipede, Marmaduke, and now we'll do The Illusionist.
Yeah, let's just all calm down. You know, we've had explosions, we've had man-eating piranha, Kelly Brook naked. Let's just take it down. Let's all be calm, because The Illusionist is a very gentle, animated French film made by the guy Sylvain Chomet, who made Bellevue Rendezvous. It's an old Jacques Tati script that he wrote that was hidden away for years in his drawer. You know, the guy who did Mononcle, the classic French slapstick film genius, some would say. And it's a very gentle, calm, beautiful piece of animation. It's basically the story of a guy who's an old school magician at the end of the 50s, early 60s, when people are getting into pop music and show business and stuff like that. And he's old school. He has a rabbit in his hat, and he's kind of he's not incompetent, but he's a little bit. He's not great, put it that way. He's not the world's best, most exciting magician. Based on what Jacques Tati looked like. And he ends up weirdly in Scotland, in Edinburgh. He meets a girl who kind of, they become friends, and she kind of sees him as an uncle figure, I think. She kind of runs away with him, really. And he basically is trying to find someone somewhere that will be interested in his act, in his old school magician routine. She just wants to kind of break free of a fairly dull, rural Scottish life. And they just kind of end up becoming friends. And that's pretty much all there is to it. There isn't much more to it than that. As I say, it's very stately, gentle, but absolutely beautiful to look at. Intricate animated vistas of Edinburgh and London. For some reason, the director moved it all to Britain. I don't really know why, apart from the fact it looks absolutely fantastic.
I think his studio is based in it.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Okay, fantastic. Thank you. I didn't know that. I absolutely adored it. It's an absolutely intricately made piece of work.
Because you know Edinburgh well. You go up there a lot.
And you sit there and you watch it and you think, oh my God, yeah. You know, almost photorealistic animated vistas of Edinburgh. It looks incredible. But it's also absolutely, really, really moving in the end. One of the reviews today in one of the tabloids said there was no great emotional connection. I was absolutely emotionally connected right from the start. It's really melancholy all the way through. And it's got a devastating, quite dark ending. He leaves a note for the girl. And I won't say what it is because it's fantastic. I thought this was an incredibly beautiful piece of work.
Nigel?
Yeah, I didn't feel quite so strongly as Boyd about it, but it is astonishing to look at. And it's interesting that in this era of Toy Story 3 and computer animation, we're used to a different style of animation altogether, that he's gone back to, in a way, a kind of mid-period Disney, which is the Aristocats and 101 Dalmatians, which is real pen and ink stuff, but so intricate and done with such detail and such love and affection that it evokes Edinburgh in the late 50s, and people who live there say it's uncanny. You know, he's literally sort of drawn all of the shop fronts and stuff like that. The story itself, I got less involved in, and it's interesting that it's been suggested that Jacques Tati actually put this in a drawer because it was in part a sort of love letter to his own daughter, who he'd neglected because he was a bit of a workaholic, and he felt he'd sort of written this, but it didn't really fit in with the character he created him for himself in things like Monsieur Hulot's Holiday. So he sort of slipped it into the drawer. And it's interesting that it's been brought out again now and made by somebody else. And it is made with a lot of skill and with a lot of love. But I didn't feel the same emotional connection that a lot of people have. I mean, people are giving this 5 stars, 5 stars, 5 stars right across the board. I didn't feel it was that strong.
Not 5 stars from Nigel.
No.
Let's go from a French film set in Edinburgh to a Korean film.
Yeah, this is another really interesting films this week. This is why we're doing all seven, because they've all got something fascinating about them. This is a Korean film by the guy who directed The Host, which was a monster movie a couple of years ago. Basically a giant tadpole laid waste to huge areas of Korea, and was huge fun and was brilliantly made. This is a completely different kind of film. It's about a mother investigating her son, who's kind of a simpleton, and he seems to have been set up. He's suspected of murder, and she doesn't think he did it. We don't quite know whether he's done it or not. And he's in prison. She basically goes on the rampage in her local town, trying to investigate whether he did or not, because the police are convinced he's guilty. And just to set this film up, it's the opening shot is this mother who's 70 years old, who's a classic actress in Korea. She's one of the most famous actresses in Korea. And she stands there doing this really bizarre dance. That's the opening scene in a field. And it eye-catching, astonishing, weird, peculiar scene. It's like something out of a David Lynch film. And it doesn't let up from there. I thought this is a remarkable piece of work. Absolutely gripping from the start, because it is a detective story, but it's weird, it's bizarre, the shots are strange, the acting is strange, the main characters are strange, but it absolutely had me right from the start, completely gripped me, and it's very accessible. You know, it's a Korean, it's one of those subtitled Korean art house films, but if people go and see it, I think they're going to love it, because it's very weird, unusual, but absolutely will grip you like a vice from the start. And it plays out in an incredibly fascinating way.
It does, it does. This guy, Bong Joon-ho, who made also made Memories of Murder and The Host. Now, the funny thing about his films is, when you watch The Host, it's like 4 different films at once. It's like a monster movie, it's like a police procedural movie, it's like a family drama. There's loads of knockabout comedy in it. You kind of go, what kind of a film is this? But he's a guy who's not constrained by genre conventions at all. So when this film starts, you think you know exactly where you're going. What you're going to get is you're going to get an uplifting story about a woman who her son has been accused of this appalling murder of this young girl. She's going to go out there, despite the fact that the police are completely apathetic, the lawyer that she employs is just taking the money, doesn't appear to want to do any work. So she says, right, I'm going to find out for myself. I'm going to investigate. I'm going to dedicate my life to this. And you think you know exactly where it's going. And if this were a Hollywood movie, you would know every beat and every moment and every scene. But nothing that you expect is going to happen happens in this film. And it happens in such an interesting and such an involving way. I really, really loved it. It was good.
It is brilliant. And it's her against all these men. It's her tackling the kind of male populace of her town.
We're now going to move on to the film that we've been having to call editorial guidance to ask them much of the plot we can talk
about.
Let's
all take a deep breath.
It is The Human Centipede.
The Human Centipede. I saw this at Fright Fest last year, so it's taken a while to come through. In brief, 2 American tourists of the kind that you would find in a film like Hostel. Their car breaks down in Germany whilst they're on holiday there. They walk through a wood. They come to a fantastic modernist house that is occupied by a German doctor with a very slab-like face. He looks like the kind of guy you would not trust, and especially not on a very dark, wet night in the middle of the forest. And he turns out to be exactly that. Basically, this guy has an obsession about creating the human centipede. In other words, he wants to combine a number of individual humans into a composite creature with lots and lots of segments. These two and another Japanese guy who's been abducted earlier are then experimented upon in what begins to look like a kind of David Cronenberg film. You think really it's going to be about sort of body horror and the way that they're experimented upon. And to some extent it is. The problem is, once he's created the monster, once he's created the human centipede, and you begin to realise the full horror of that, much of which we can't talk about, there isn't really anywhere for the film to go, and it then has to fall back on rather conventional thriller elements, like a couple of rather shabby German plainclothes police come to the door and start asking questions. Is he going to get away with it? Are they going to discover what he's got hidden down in the basement?
So how soon into the film is the monster created?
The monster gets created about halfway through. There's a certain amount of chasing around before that, and it's clear what's going to happen because he used to operate as a separating Siamese twins. And he also has in his garden a little grave to my sweet three dog. So obviously he's been there before with his dogs, and you know pretty much what's going to happen. But once it gets there, I think we will agree, it doesn't really have anywhere to go.
Tom in Scarborough says he's seen it. Badly acted, creepy but strangely watchable, a page turner even. That would be my review of The Human Centipede. I honestly don't know how you can review it live on air, though. But Mikey in Edinburgh saw it where you did last year at Fright Fest. He says afterwards there was a Q&A. He asked the director, Tom Six, about what his sister reacted when he handed over the script and asked her to be a producer on it. He said she should have punched him in the face. It's the strangest brother and sister made film in history.
Yeah, I mean, nothing much shocks me at all, but this is the most disgusting film I've ever seen, I think. It is horrendous and horrible and nasty, and it's not scary. I mean, I don't think it's ever scary. It's just, it's not really played in that way. So it's very odd, because it is Cronenbergian a little bit, certainly the idea of it. And the way it's filmed, it's technically very good. You know, this guy's clearly talented, I think, because, you know, it looks great. Even though it's a hideous horror Z-movie idea, it's kind of, the production values are pretty high, weirdly, which makes it even more horrendous for me. I mean, it's really unpleasant, you know, and I think unless you have an attraction to grotesque unpleasantness in the cinema, steer clear, because it's not enjoyable for me. And I agree with Nigel that once the centipede is revealed, it's just nowhere to go, and ends up being a little bit boring, the second half, to me. I just wanted it to end. Get over with. Get the disgustingness over with, for God's sake.
A grotesque unpleasantness. Will those words appear in your review of Marmaduke?
A little bit. Do you know what? Yes, because Marmaduke, which is based on an ancient American comic strip that's been going decades, since the 50s, I think. So it's all about this talking dog. But the weird thing about it is the dog talks, and the mouth, watching this dog's mouth moving, is kind of horrible. That's the big flaw with this film. So, you know, the whole concept of it is a little bit flawed because it's not particularly enjoyable. Remember Garfield, you know, the cat movie? That was fine because you didn't see Garfield's mouth moving, you just heard the voice. And whereas in this, it's kind of a little bit unpleasant to look at, I felt, anyway. And I didn't feel, I saw it in a cinema full of kids, I didn't feel they're enjoying it. It's one of the worst family movies of the year, I think. It's even worse than Cats and Dogs.
It's not good, it's not good. Oddly enough, this is a film with a U certificate made for very young children. I mean, it's about cats and, you know, dogs who talk. So it's kind of like Cats and Dogs and Revenge of Kitty Galore. So we're in the same territory here. But it's set up in such a way that all of the interactions between the various types of dogs are related to teen movies. So it's kind of like, so you've got the jock dogs, you know, the kind of the Doberman Pinschers and stuff like that. And then you've got the kind of the Heathers style, you know,
but
girls.
None of them are funny, are they?
And none of them are funny. No, but, you know, it's all set up like it's some kind of a teen movie, but it's for kids.
We've got 10 seconds left, £10 and your Friday night. Which film?
If you can see Mother, it's brilliant.
Yeah, Mother or Piranha 3D.
Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.